brazier had come off the wall and stood, its glass fractured within its frame, against the wall. "What happened to him?" said Kate, still staring at the photograph. "To both of them?"
"They didn't go back to China. When we came back to Ireland, I found Wei Yip a good position with a Black Watch family up in the New Territories. I think she was much happier there, really. She was nearer to her family. And things were..."
Joy took a deep breath. "Simpler." Kate stared at the photograph again, then placed it carefully on top of the box, leaving her fingertips lightly upon its surface. She paused, as if deciding whether to turn it over, but left it face upwards. "I can't believe this," she said, almost to herself. "I can't believe Daddy..." "I thought you were perfect," she said. "I really thought the two of you had this perfect love."
"No one's perfect, Catherine."
The two women sat in silence at right angles to each other, listening to the distant sounds of activity in the stable yard. For once, Kate noted, it didn't seem to stir Joy into action. "Why did you stay?" she said. "It was the '60s by then, wasn't it? People would have understood. We would have understood." Joy frowned, a hand raised to her hair.
"I did think about it. But there was still quite a stigma about it back then. And despite everything, I decided I was doing the right thing. I thought this way, you children would grow up with a proper family, without having to cope with people whispering and pointing and talking. And we had built a life together. I suppose we liked the same things."
She turned to look at Kate, and her expression softened.
"Both of us loved you so much, you know. Your happiness was everything to us. And although your father hurt me terribly..." Here she winced slightly, and Kate realized with a sense of shock how close to the surface that betrayal still sat. "I decided that in the end, my own feelings were not the most important thing." There was a lengthy silence as Kate sat in the cold, unloved room, trying to bend her long-held beliefs around this new knowledge. She felt briefly, irrationally angry, as if it had been her exclusion from this secret that had caused all the problems between them. "Does Christopher know?"
"Of course Christopher doesn't know. And I don't want him to know. I didn't want either of you to know." Joy sounded momentarily like her old brusque self.
"You're not to say anything to him, or Sabine. There's far too much rubbish about telling everybody everything these days."
Her voice, although truculent, held something else, something almost tearful. Kate stood, looking at her mother for a few moments, slowly recognizing the love story she had missed. Then she stepped forward, and for the first time since she had been a child, took hold of Joy, gently enfolding her in her arms, allowing her mother time for her habitual stiffness to be replaced by something more yielding. She smelt of horse and dog, and something sweet and lavendery. After some moments, she patted Kate's shoulder absently in return, as if comforting an animal.
"All these years," Kate said into her quilted jacket, her voice breaking. "All these years, and I could never live up to you."
"I'm sorry, darling. I didn't mean you to feel that way."
"No, I didn't mean that. All those years, and I didn't know that you were suffering. I didn't know what you had had to put up with."
Joy pulled back and wiped at her eyes, straightening her shoulders.
"Now, I don't want you exaggerating," she said firmly. "Your father is a good man. I didn't have to put up with so much, as you call it. He loved me, in his way."
When she looked at Kate, her gaze was defensive, faintly challenging.
He... He just couldn't help himself.
Joy turned away from her towards the window. Kate glanced next door to where her father was dozing in his drug-fueled slumber, feeling a cold fury towards the man who had betrayed the only person she had ever thought him capable of loving unconditionally.
"And you never made him pay for it," she said bitterly.
Joy followed her daughter's glance, then reached out, taking her hand. Joy's was roughened, weathered by ages of determined activity.
"You're not to say a thing to him. You're not to bother him."
"Your father did pay, Kate," she said, and her voice held a melancholy certainty. "Both of us paid."
There was no one in the downstairs kitchen or the drawing room, so Sabine, now almost light-headed with adrenaline, ran through the house, slamming doors and yelling for Mrs. H., making the dogs bark and scrabble in pursuit. "Where the hell is everyone?" she yelled, throwing open and shut the doors of the pantry and the boot room. The house felt still, watchful. The snug and the breakfast room were also uninhabited, their silence amplifying the sounds of her brief entry, making them reverberate around the furniture. Her lungs now tight from her exertions, Sabine ran up the stairs two at a time, her boots catching on the threadbare stair carpet, so that she slipped and slithered on her way up, having to clutch at the banister twice to stop herself from falling. All the time, the vision of Annie loomed before her, bowed over by her suffering, her expression distant as ever, but this time somehow focused, somehow primeval.
Oh, God, where was Mrs. H? Annie needed her mother. That much was clear to anyone. She certainly needed someone more than Anthony, whatever his name was.
Sabine stopped briefly on the landing, looking for the vacuum cleaner or some other clue that Mrs. H had recently been there. Then it came to her.
Linda! Why hadn't she thought of Linda? She would know what to do. She could take care of it all.
Sabine threw open the door of her grandfather's room, her mouth already open and prepared to deliver her urgent message. But she met only the blank gaze of the off-turned television set and a neat array of plastic cups and pill bottles, a silent reminder that the nurse had already left for home. Her grandfather's skeletal profile emerged from the layers of bedding and pillows, undisturbed by the commotion, deep in chemically induced slumber. She didn't even bother to close the door. With a sobbed expletive of exasperation, Sabine now ran along the corridor, flinging open each door and shouting for Mrs. H., her mother, her grandmother, anyone as she did so, fighting with each step a rising sense of panic about the scene she had left behind.
What if that man went away? He had looked like he was desperate to leave. What if everyone had gone out? She could call an ambulance, but she didn't know how to help.
And a little part of her didn't really want to go back to that noise, that blood, all by herself. They were in the study. Sabine thrust open the door, not expecting to find anyone in there, and stopped, panting, as she confronted the sight of the two women holding on to each other. She stood for a second, trying to take in a scene that she knew couldn't possibly be real. Still conscious of the evening's events, she looked away from her mother. Then she remembered herself.
"Where's Mrs. H?"
Her grandmother had pulled away from her mother and pawed at her sticking-up hair. "She's gone to town to see someone about Annie, I think." She looked almost embarrassed to be found in such an intimate embrace.
"I've got to speak to her."
"Well, she won't be back here this evening. She left early. I think Mac came to pick her up." The two women stared at Sabine, who was now hopping from leg to leg in agitation.
"What on earth is the matter?" "We need to get her. It's Annie. She... I think she's having a baby."
There was the shortest of silences.
"What? A baby? Are you sure?"
Outside the door, infected by the excitement, one of the dogs was barking.
"Annie can't have children," said Joy, unconvinced.
"Sabine, are you sure?" "Look, come on. I'm not making it up," said Sabine, pulling at her grandmother's sleeve. "She's in the house. With one of the guests. But there's stuff on the floor and everything. And he says he's only a loans clerk, but she hasn't got long to go, and we need to get an ambulance, and Annie's phone isn't working.
Joy and Kate exchanged looks.
He's all by himself, said Sabine,
reduced to near tears by their stupid frozen faces.
Annie needs help. You've got to come now.
Joy placed her hand against her face, thinking, then strode towards the door, propelling the younger women before her. Kate, you run down there with Sabine. I'll ring an ambulance and gather up some things here. Oh, my goodness, I'll try to ring Mac as well. I'm sure we have one of those mobile telephone numbers for him somewhere. I'll get Tom to do it.
You lead the way, said Kate, as she followed her daughter's rapid descent of the stairs, almost falling over the dogs as she went.
Oh, that poor woman,
she said, putting her hand out to pat Sabine's shoulder.
Thank God you found her.
Anthony Fleming was doing a little dance on the step outside Annie's house, a curious jig accompanied by the merry waving of arms, a Morris dancer out of time with some mental tune. At least that was how it looked from afar. When Sabine and Kate got close, sweating and breathing hard from their sprint, it revealed itself as an anxious shifting of weight, a desperate fumbling plea for help from arms that clutched hold of Kate's lapels when she ran up the steps.
"Are you a doctor?" he said, his face pale and anxious.
"The doctor's on his way," said Kate. "Where is she?"
"Oh, God! Oh, God!"
Anthony Fleming wrung his hands.
"Where is she?"
Ignoring him and Sabine, Kate pushed her way through the living room into the kitchen, then swiftly crouched down by Annie, who was now hanging on to the base of a kitchen stool, rocking backwards and forwards, and letting out low, keening noises that made the hairs on the back of Sabine's neck stand on end.
"You're all right now. You're all right, Annie," Kate repeated, holding on to her, smoothing her hair. "You're doing really well. It's all going to be fine."
Sabine stared at the kitchen, at Annie's long skirt, which lay discarded and soaked in the corner by the sink, at some stained scrap of pink fabric that might have been her knickers. There was pale, watery blood everywhere. It made her think of the time her grandfather had fallen into the vegetable casserole.
"I don't know anything about babies," Anthony Fleming kept repeating, his hands wrestling with each other. "I only do bank loans. I only came back because she had somewhere safe to put my bike."
Sabine couldn't answer him. She was staring at Annie, who, lost in some private world, was now hanging on to Kate, her face occasionally contorted as she let out another bovine cry. Kate, glancing behind her at her daughter's shocked face, tried to smile.
"It's all right, darling, honestly. Looks worse than it is. Why don't you go outside and wait for the ambulance to come?"
"I'll do that," interjected Anthony Fleming, who was already making for the door.
"I'll wait for the ambulance. I'll wait outside."
Kate cast an irritated glance at his departing back. She kept looking at her watch, marking the distance between Annie's anguished noises.
"Okay. Okay, Sabine, go and find some towels, okay? And a pair of scissors. Then boil the kettle and sterilize the scissors, all right?" "You're not going to cut her open, are you?"
Sabine, still frozen at the kitchen door, felt her chest compress with fear. She didn't think she could cope with the sight of any more blood.
"No, darling, it's for the cord, just in case the baby comes before the ambulance does. Go on, we don't have an awful lot of time."
She turned back to Annie, stroking her hair, murmuring words of encouragement, heedless of the fact that she herself was now covered in the bloodied liquid from where she had been supporting Annie on the floor.
"I need to push," said Annie,
her hair stuck in sweaty tendrils around her face. They were the first words Sabine had heard her say.
"Oh, God, I need to push. Sabine, go now."
Sabine turned to run from the room, unsure where she was going to find any scissors. Annie's house didn't look like anything would be where you might expect it, and bumped into Joy, who was holding a bundle of towels.
"The ambulance should be here any minute," she said. "Tom's trying to get hold of Mrs. H. Where are they?"
"Have you got scissors?"
"Yes, yes.
Joy was following the long, lowing sound, which this time raised up into something unearthly, nearer a scream.
"We've got everything. In the kitchen, are they?"
The noise, when it came again, was too horrible. It made Sabine chill, like the sound of the hounds howling in the night. It sounded like Annie was going to die. Her face crumpled. Joy's expression softened as she caught sight of her granddaughter's fear, and she reached out a hand to comfort her.
"It's all right, Sabine, really. Birth is just a bit of a brutal business."
"Is she going to die? I don't want Annie to die."
Joy smiled and squeezed her arm before turning towards the kitchen.
"Of course she won't die. A minute after that baby is born, she won't remember a thing about all this."
Sabine watched from behind the door as Joy moved past her and crouched down next to Kate, handing over the towels and helping arrange Annie's limbs on the floor, stroking her legs and murmuring something cheerful as she did so. Kate said something about transition, and she and Joy looked at each other briefly. Their faces had an expression not just of mutual understanding and concern, but a faint hint of impending joy, as if they both knew something that they couldn't yet acknowledge. Sabine, watching it, found herself tearful again, but not because she felt excluded. She felt comforted.
"Okay, Annie," said Kate, who was now at Annie's feet. "You get ready to push. You say when you feel the next one coming."
Annie stared wide-eyed at her feet, and then, with her chin to her chest, let out a lengthy roar, at first through clenched teeth, and then through a mouth so wide open that Sabine, peeping round the doorframe, found her own mouth unconsciously mimicking its action. Joy was wincing as she tried to hold Annie's upper half, her face flushed with effort. Kate pushed Annie's knees up and wiped her face with a cold flannel. She was half crying now.
"You're nearly there, Annie. I can see the head. You're nearly there."
Annie's eyes opened briefly to look at Kate. They were exhausted, bewildered.
"Deep breaths, Annie. Just keep your chin down, and it will soon be over." "Where's Patrick?" said Annie blearily.
"Patrick is coming," said Joy firmly, her face pressed up close to Annie's, her arms supporting her under her armpits. "Patrick is coming, and your parents are coming, and the ambulance is coming, so you're not to worry. You just concentrate on that lovely baby."
"I want Patrick,"
said Annie, beginning to cry. And then her tears became strangled as another contraction gripped her body, and her sob turned into another huge roar. And she gripped at the arms supporting her so fiercely that Sabine could see her grandmother grimacing, and Kate was still down in front of her, her hands pushing Annie's ankles so that her knees were up, her voice offering words of encouragement.
"It's coming, Annie. Go on, push now. It's really coming. I can see the head."
Kate's voice was shrill with excitement, her face lifting to Annie's with a broad smile. Annie fell back against Joy, exhausted.
"I can't do it," she said.
"You can. You're nearly there," said the two women in unison.
"Just pant, Annie," said Kate. "Keep panting for a minute."
She looked at her mother, adding quietly, "That's right, isn't it, Mum?" Joy nodded, and they half smiled at each other again.
"Okay, now one more push," Kate said. And then Annie began to yell, a long, wavering, strangulated note. And Kate began to yell. And Joy, who was still wincing because of the hold Annie had on her arms, began to yell. And Sabine found she was crying now, without realizing it, because just when she thought she couldn't bear it, there was a brief wet slithering and a shout of blood and joy, and her mother was holding this thing with its two purple arms thrust high in the air, like a football fan. And Joy was kissing Annie and laughing, and Kate was wrapping it tenderly in a towel and placing it on Annie's chest, and the three of them had their arms around each other. And through it all, Sabine kept watching Annie's face with its raw expression of joy and pain and relief, oblivious to the blood and gore,
oblivious to the noise, oblivious to Anthony Fleming, who was standing at the door, a hemming into his hand, and asking everybody to excuse him, but the ambulance was here. Then Kate, as if she had suddenly remembered Sabine, looked up and reached out to her, and Sabine walked over and knelt down with them, and gazed at this thing, which was covered in blood and wrapped up in a beach towel, smelling of sweat and iron. And as she looked down, she couldn't see the pools of blood, the sodden towels, the knickers, the mess it had made of her own trousers. She just saw two milky dark eyes gazing steadily back at her, in that ancient way that suggested knowledge of all the secrets of the world. A tiny downy mouth shaped silent words, telling her everything she had never known about what life meant. She realized, with a brief burst of clarity, that she had never seen anything more beautiful in her whole life.
"A little girl," said Kate,
her eyes wet with tears, squeezing her daughter's shoulders.
"She's so perfect," Sabine said, reaching out a tentative hand.
"My baby," said Annie, gazing at her, disbelieving.
"My baby."
And then, without warning, she began to sob great wrenching sobs that ravaged her whole body, pummeling her under the weight of withheld grief that went on and on and on, so that Kate had briefly to take the baby back to protect her from Annie's anguish. And Joy leant forward, clutching Annie's head, crying, "I know, I know." And then, as Annie's tears eventually subsided, had told her, so quietly that Sabine could only just make it out above the exclamations of the people coming in, "It's all right now, Annie. It's all right. It's all over." And then Kate, her own hand shaking, had helped pull Sabine up from the floor, and with their arms tightly around each other, they had both walked silent and blinking out into the night, where the ambulance men, under the spinning siren of blue light, officious in their neon uniforms and monitored by hissing radios, were unloading the stretcher. Chapter 16.
"There were few real surprises left in life," said Mrs. H., "but the birth of her grandchild had been one for sure." She said this many times to many people, but it didn't stop her eyes filling with grateful tears every time she said it. And that she often said it to the same people was not minded by anyone who knew her. Little Roisin Connolly was good news, and news that good could happily bear the burden of repetition. Patrick had returned to Annie on the night of the birth, deeply shocked but overjoyed at the arrival of the new baby, overwhelmed with relief at finally having an explanation of his wife's increasingly strange behaviour over the past months. Annie, who had never come to terms with her daughter's death, had become temporarily unbalanced by the shock of her new pregnancy, the doctor said, and had coped by ignoring it and distancing herself from those around her. It was not an uncommon response, apparently. Despite this, Mrs. H. had seemed rather embarrassed not to have realized that her own daughter had been pregnant, and had blamed herself for the trauma of Roisin's birth. But Mac and Tom and everyone else told her not to be so daft. And later, Annie pointed out that if she had been able to keep it from her own husband, what little chance did her mother have of guessing? Mrs. H. was vaguely appeased, but could often be seen studying the waistlines of various local women, keen to be the first to guess any future pregnancies, and several times causing mild offence by asking. Annie spent several weeks in hospital, both to keep Roisin company, as she had arrived a little over a month prematurely and had to spend time in an incubator.
but also to give herself time to adapt to her renewed role of motherhood under the watchful eye of the health authorities. After an initial period of delayed grieving for Neve, the two babies, it was agreed, were heartbreakingly similar in appearance. She had recovered astonishingly quickly, suffering none of the postnatal depression that the doctors had warned was often a feature in cases like these. And she had her counselling, although Mrs. H. said to see her with her little baby and her husband's arm round her was all the counselling anyone needed. Annie even talked about Neve now, pointing out how similar Roisin was in feeding or winding habits, and how dissimilar in the shape of her tiny seashell fingernails or the colour of her hair. And sometimes she even told off visiting relatives for crying when she did so, saying that while she wanted to remember that she had had two daughters, she wouldn't have Roisin growing up in Neve's shadow. Sabine visited her several times, holding the tiny child carefully in her arms, marvelling at how quickly she had lost her squashed and bloodied appearance and become something alert and pink and sweet-smelling. She didn't want to have her own baby, though, she told Annie. Not until they could make boys have them. Annie, who, as Joy had predicted, seemed astonishingly to have forgotten all the pain and blood, had laughed at that. She laughed quite often these days, her eyes glinting with mischief when she teased Sabine about Bobby McAndrew, and with delight when her little daughter did something apparently remarkable, like wave a starfish hand in the air or sneeze. Secretly, Sabine thought Roisin was still a bit of a blob, but she didn't say that. Annie had asked her to be a godmother, and even she knew that that wasn't a particularly godmotherish thing to say. Patrick, who was almost always at the hospital, making a nuisance of himself, the smiling nurses said, just sat and gazed at his daughter, his big dark face radiating a soft beam of satisfaction, his hands no longer reaching anxiously to stroke or comfort his wife, but most often comfortably entwined in hers. "He hadn't done any work for weeks," said Mrs. H., "but then you couldn't have everything." He had wept tears of gratitude at Sabine, Joy, and Kate when he had arrived at the house, so that Sabine had been a little embarrassed for him. But Kate had hugged him, herself tearful, and kept saying that she was so, so happy, as if it was she who had given birth. A child, Joy had told Sabine, still a little emotional herself, was the greatest gift anyone could have. One day she would understand. Sabine thought privately that she probably did understand. She had never witnessed anything like Annie's expression when she had first laid eyes on her new daughter. That explosive mixture of joy and pain and relief. Thinking about it now made her want to get emotional, not that she ever let anyone know. There was quite enough sentimental stuff going on these days as it was. Tom never told Kate about Sabine's failed attempt to seduce him. Or perhaps he did, and her mother had decided not to say anything to her about it. Either way, Sabine was grateful. And a little wrong-footed by not knowing who it was she should be feeling grateful to. She had first seen him again on the night of Roisin's birth. He had come running down the road shortly after Sabine and Kate had emerged from the house and were standing by the ambulance, not really knowing what to do next. He had skidded to a halt in front of them, his eyes darting from one to the other, a hand on each. "Is everything okay?" he had said. "Is Annie okay? Are you okay?" He had looked very hard at Sabine when he said the last bit, and she had nodded, too full of the drama of the baby's arrival still to feel humiliated. Suddenly it had all seemed such a long time ago, an almost dreamlike scenario, as if it had happened to someone else. She had waited, tense, for him to kiss her mother, or wrap his arms around her or something. But he hadn't. They had just looked at each other, and then Kate had told him quietly to go inside and see Annie. and after he had gone in, she had steered Sabine towards home, saying, "I don't know about you, sweetheart, but I could certainly do with a drink." And then she had seen him the next day. Tom had waited till Sabine came to the yard, then asked if she wanted to go for a ride. Just the two of them. She had looked over the grey's door to find him already brushed off and saddled, as if she were being given no choice. Sabine had felt more awkward then, even though it was obvious from the tone of his voice that he wasn't going to make a pass at her or anything. The thought that he might say something about the previous evening was somehow more excruciating. But he had behaved like nothing had happened, had chatted about horses and Annie and the new baby, and how stunned everybody was, and had taken her on a long meandering ride across country, encouraging her to jump a couple of ditches that she wouldn't have managed on her own, and laughing when she refused point blank to attempt a Wexford bank. "Yes," she said, trying not to laugh back at him. She knew she had done it before, but it was different seeing things in cold blood. He had nodded at that and said she wasn't wrong, as if she had said something much wiser than she had meant. It wasn't as if anything big had happened between them on the ride, but when she came back, she felt relaxed again, as if Tom were restored to her, as someone to talk to at least. Besides, she thought, having studied him quite hard when she knew he wasn't looking, she might not fancy him so much now, especially after her mother had told her how close Tom had come to being her father. You couldn't look at anyone the same way after that. Predictably, it was less simple with her mother. The day after the baby, Kate had still been all emotional and quivery, saying she couldn't eat breakfast, and drifting off into daydreams that made her eyes fill with tears. She had also, rather self-consciously, hugged Joy at the breakfast table, which Sabine found a little excessive, although Mrs. H. said afterwards that it was just lovely, that they were all friends again, especially after all this time. Then again, Mrs. H. thought everything was just lovely for weeks. She even said it once when Linda announced that she had picked up a parking ticket in New Ross. Sabine, who had felt increasingly embarrassed at how frightened she had been at the birth, and how much they had all hung on to each other, had decided to be very cool about everything. "It was only a baby, after all," she said, when they threatened to go on about it for too long. It had been rather irritating, the way her mother and grandmother had exchanged glances, and smirked when she did, like they had always shared some kind of empathy and knew what she was doing. However, Kate had got something right. She had come up to see her several days later, as she was getting changed, and sitting on Sabine's bed, had asked quite bluntly whether she would prefer to stay in Ireland or go back to England. Sabine, her thick blue jumper halfway over her head, had said through the wool, secretly glad that she didn't have to see her mother's face, that she quite liked Ireland, and that she thought that she could do her next exams here just as well. Surprisingly, her mother hadn't cried. She'd sounded upbeat, and said that if that was what Sabine wanted, then that's what they should do. Then she had left. No soul-searching, no droning on and on about how she wanted to be her friend and just wanted them to be happy, blah, blah, blah. Just matter of fact. Sabine had been quite shocked to emerge from the jumper to find her already gone. Then a couple of days later, when they were alone in the drawing room, she asked Sabine how she would feel about them selling their house in Hackney and moving over here to be near Granny permanently. "You mean you want to be near Tom," Sabine thought, but she was too surprised that her opinion counted to be too mean about it. "I thought we could buy one of the cottages up the road," said Kate, who looked more cheerful than Sabine had seen her in ages. "Something nearby, just a two-bedroom thing, because we'd have plenty over from the sale of the London house. And there's no reason why I can't work from here. We could have fun choosing something." Suddenly wary, Sabine had wanted to ask her if Tom was going to move in with them, but Kate had preempted her. "Tom is going to stay where he is for the time being. I think there's quite enough upheaval in this family for now. But he will be spending a lot of time with us, if that's okay by you."
"So what is it? Didn't he want to move in?" said Sabine,
failing to keep the hint of derision from her voice. It was like history repeating itself.
"I haven't asked him, darling," said Kate. "I thought it was about time you and I had a bit of fun by ourselves."
Then she added, "And we both know where to find him, don't we?"
Joy had been okay about her mum and Tom, too. Sabine had told her grandmother almost warily, expecting some gruff expression of disapproval.
But Joy, who had curiously seemed to know already, had not even looked up from her horse and hound and said that Tom was a good man and that she was sure he knew what he was doing.
She hadn't actually said the same of Kate, Sabine realized afterwards, but as Mrs. H said, you couldn't have everything.
Bobby, meanwhile, had made some crummy joke when she told him she was staying, something along the lines of her not being able to leave him alone. But when she managed to shut him up for 5 minutes, he did say that she'd have a grand time getting to know what he described as the rest of the gang, and he told her about a hunt ball in 2 weeks' time that they could go to, and a party at Adamstown this weekend, where there was going to be a live band, and where, he said, they would have the best laugh. He seemed pretty pleased, really. She didn't like to tell him she'd started to develop the teensiest of crushes on his elder brother. Edward Ballantyne died 3 weeks to the day after Roisin Connolly's birth, slipping quietly and efficiently away between the lunchtime news and the first of Linda's afternoon soaps.
"It was all right," Linda told Mrs. H. afterwards.
"She always made sure she videoed all her episodes at home, in case of just such an eventuality."
Mrs. H. was rather tight-lipped with her after that.
Sabine, who had been out riding with Bobby at Manor Farm, had been inconsolable when she returned, blaming herself for him being on his own when he went, although even she had had to admit that he seemed barely to wake up any more. But Joy had led her into his room and sat with her next to the bed and held her until she stopped crying. And Sabine had had to acknowledge, as her grandmother said, that he looked much more peaceful now. At least, what remained of her grandfather. It was as if the little essence of him that had remained had drifted away, leaving just this placid, sunken old face and almost cold hands, which lay on the scarlet quilt, like relics of another life. Sabine had thought briefly of Tom's hand when she first touched it. But Tom's hand, while not a living thing, was somehow infused with his own zest for life. Her grandfather's hands were like dusty, crepey museum exhibits, carrying only the most distant echoes of times past. "You shouldn't have made her sit with him," said Kate, who had been waiting in the corridor, pale and grim-faced, when they emerged. "She'll have nightmares."
"Rubbish," said her grandmother, who was curiously composed and dry-eyed. "He was her grandfather. She had a right to say goodbye to him." "Do you good to say goodbye to him, too." But Kate, one hand to her face, had disappeared into her room for a couple of hours. Christopher and Julia had arrived that evening, Julia already dressed in black, and so tearful that she had to be repeatedly comforted by Joy.
"I can't bear it," she said,
sobbing into the older woman's shoulder.
"I'm no good with death."
"As if anybody was," said Mrs. H. disapprovingly.
Julia also took pains to tell Joy at every opportunity that she knew how she felt. It was less than a year since she had lost Mamselle, after all. Christopher, meanwhile, had just looked rather pale and corpse-like himself, and spoke as if he had a mouthful of corks. He had rubbed Kate's back awkwardly when she had come downstairs, and said he hoped that things wouldn't get difficult. Sabine knew he was talking about the furniture with labels on, but Kate said that she was going to leave everything up to Mummy. It was her house, after all, her things. It wasn't as if either of them were in dire financial straits, and Christopher had nodded and left her pretty well alone, which seemed to suit both of them. Joy had busied herself with the funeral arrangements, declining all offers of help, but not in the rigid, brusque manner she had employed while her husband was dying. Now, while still briskly efficient, she had become gentler, as if all her hard edges had been smoothed off, and a little meditative.
"She'll lose it later on," Julius sniffed mournfully, watching Joy's departing back as they sat in the drawing-room after supper. "Delayed grief, that's what it will be. It didn't hit me properly about Mademoiselle until we buried her."
But if the grief came, Joy didn't show it, and Linda especially seemed almost offended by the lack of hysteria in the Ballantyne household.
"I've got some sedatives just in case," she would say to anyone who passed, as she packed up her belongings to leave. "You only have to say the word."
Julia took one in the end.
"She didn't really need it," she confided to Kate afterwards. "She just thought it gave the right impression somehow. She didn't want Linda telling everyone in Wexford that the Ballantynes were uncaring after all."
Despite Julia's impressions to the contrary, Sabine was rather shocked at how sad her mother became after Grandfather's death. Not her usual annoying, showy-offy sadness, which manifested itself in tears and tugging at her hair and smudged mascara. That would have made Sabine cross. She felt she had somehow greater grief rights than her mother when it came to her grandfather. She was just really, really quiet and pale. So much so that when Sabine caught sight of her near the summer house, being hugged by a sympathetic Tom, her first response was not anger or even irritation, but relief that somebody might be doing something to help. She still found physical contact with her mother inexplicably difficult, and would withdraw from her embrace as soon as she could without causing offence. But her mother's sadness affected her. Sabine had cried hugely for 2 days, and then felt secretly better. Her mother looked peculiar, and a little bit frustrated, like she was struggling with things she couldn't convey.
"How come you were so sad about Grandfather?" Sabine asked eventually, as they sat in the study, packing the last 2 boxes in silence, a cooling mug of tea beside each. The room, now reduced to a few skeletal shelves and unevenly faded wallpaper, was going to be redecorated and resurrected as a bedroom. As one of the few remaining dry rooms in the house, it needed, Christopher said, to be utilised effectively, perhaps for bed and breakfast. There would be a hole in the market, after all, now that Annie and Patrick were closing their doors.
"Don't worry," said Mrs. H. at Sabine's appalled response. "She'll soon frighten them off."
So Sabine and her mother had jointly taken charge of the final boxes in the study. Sabine, having picked out her favourite photographs, was now sorting through the leftover bits of correspondence, secretly hoping that she would find a really juicy love letter. The photographs, which were now in chronological order, were going to be mounted in a leather album, her mother had decided, as a present for Granny. Most of them, anyway.
"I'm not being rude or anything, but it wasn't as if you ever talked about him much when he was alive," she eyed her mother, aware that her words did not sound quite as gentle spoken out loud as they had in her head. Kate placed the lid on the sturdy brown box and paused for a minute, wiping dust from her nose. "There were things," she began, and then paused. I suppose I just wish Daddy and I had understood each other a little better. We wasted so much time, and now it's too late. That makes me a bit cross and a bit sad." Sabine leant on the desk, fiddling with an old pen, unsure how to respond. Kate turned towards her. "I suppose I just wish we'd had a chance to be better friends. We stopped being close when I was not much older than you.
Why?
Oh, the usual. He didn't approve of how I lived my life. He approved even less once I had you. Not that he didn't love you, she added quickly. Sabine shrugged.
I know.
She harboured a secret belief that by the end, her grandfather had loved her more than anyone. They sat in silence for a while, Sabine sifting through the faded documents, only really bothering to read the ones that were handwritten. There were lots of postcards addressed to Kate and Christopher in her grandfather's now familiarly angular, austere handwriting, telling them the names of various ships he had been on and weather conditions of places he had visited. He seemed to have gone away for a bit after Kate was born, but she couldn't find any address just to grandmother. Kate sat staring out of the window, apparently still lost in thought. I've been remembering how lovely he was to me when I was a child, she said into the silence, so that Sabine looked up sharply. He was always taking me places, down to the dockyards to see his work, up on the Peak tram, out to the little islands around Hong Kong, so that Christopher and I could go exploring. He was a pretty good father, you know. Sabine looked at her, noting her mother's faintly defensive tone. He was all right, for an old stick. She tried to hide the catch in her voice. She still found it quite hard to talk about him. I guess I would have liked him to have been proud of me, Kate said sadly. It's pretty hard, feeling like you get everything wrong in the eyes of those you love. She glanced at her daughter, a smile playing around her lips. Yes, believe it or not, even at my age. Sabine looked at her mother for a while. Then she reached out a hand. I don't think you get everything wrong, she said, her voice low and rushed, as if betraying a confidence. I know I'm not very nice to you sometimes, but I do think you're okay as a mum. As a rule, I mean. I know that you love me and stuff, which is important. She had started to blush. And I bet Grandfather was proud of you, she continued. I bet he was, really, but he just couldn't show it. They were never very good at emotions, Grandmother and Grandfather. Not like you and me. Honestly, she squeezed her mother's arm. I know. Downstairs they could hear Julia's shrill voice as she helped Mrs. H. rearrange the drawing room for after the funeral. There was a scraping sound of furniture moving, and a pause as Julia apparently burst into tears again. Kate looked at her daughter's hand, then looked up and smiled slowly. You're probably right, she said. Edward Ballantyne was buried on a day so wet that the roads around the cemetery flooded, forcing the smaller group of mourners to wade through water ankle deep in order to get near the grave, which to everyone's relief was on slightly higher ground. It had rained solidly for 2 days, turning the skies the colour of wet ashes, the grass to mud, and obscuring the various bouquets under the steam of their protective cellophane. Several of the older people from the village, having retreated to the nave of the little church, tutted at the incivility of the weather, muttering about omens and symbols. But Joy had smiled oddly to herself, ignoring her wet shoes, and said to those inquiring that she thought it fitting. She even told Sabine, matter-of-factly, to go and put her Wellingtons on if she liked, so that her granddaughter, tearful at her first funeral, had looked shocked and asked her mother whether Joy was okay. "Remember what you told me about emotions," whispered Kate, and Sabine, after some pensive thought, had seemed vaguely satisfied. "He had a good turnout. Surprising, really," said Mrs. H. from under her own umbrella, considering how rude he had been to most of the village at some time or other. But Tom, arm in arm with Kate, had whispered that people knew better than that. Besides, it was about respect, he told Kate,
who had herself been quietly amazed at the number of mourners in the church. There were few who didn't admire what he and his family had done for the hunt, and those that didn't had come for joy. "It's a blood thing. They know good breeding when they see it," he had said quietly, and squeezed Kate's arm. "They know a good wake when they see it," muttered Mrs. H., who on Joy's instructions had bought 2 whole legs of ham, a side of salmon, and enough alcohol, according to Christopher, to sink a small ship. She had observed the already lightening mood of the village mourners behind them, the distant but discernible swell of chatter as, duty over, they anticipated a good do back at the big house. Kate huddled closer under Tom's umbrella, awkward in her new black coat, grateful that the rain splashing onto her face would wash away any suggestion of tears. She had found it impossible to stay furious with her father. Her mother had seen to that. "He was only human," she had said firmly, her old hands gripping her daughter's, as she had raged against the old man on the night of his death. "Just as Kate was. And more to the point," she said, "it was not Kate's place to be angry." But that had meant that Kate was left with only the options of grief and regret at her father's departure, and a lingering guilt that, had she tried harder, she might have been able to draw one fragile line back across the gaping hole that had existed too long between the two sides of her family. "Sabine did it for you," Tom had said. "Just be glad of that." But it was too early to be glad about anything. The vicar's voice, a dull murmur under the persistent hiss of the rain, had talked of dust and ashes, and somewhere behind them, Julia, supported by Christopher, had begun to sob noisily, until apologizing profusely, she was taken away. They could hear her protesting her inability to bear it halfway back to Kilcarrion. The remaining mourners took that as a sign to start peeling away from the graveside too, and walked off alone or in pairs, under a variety of dark or gaudily inappropriate umbrellas. Annie and Patrick lingered nearby, baby Roisin invisibly pressed to her mother's chest, Patrick looming over her like a protective bear. They now stepped forward. "You let me know what I can do now," said Annie to Joy, as the vicar, with a final nod and touch of her arm, walked as briskly as he could towards the shelter of the church, his robes billowing wetly behind him. "And I mean it, Mrs. Ballantyne. You've done enough for me."
"You're very kind, Annie," said Joy, as the rain ran in torrents down the curves of her umbrella. "I'll do just that."
"She won't, you know," Annie could be heard to mutter fondly as they walked slowly away. "Stubborn as a mule, that woman." And that left only Tom, Kate, Sabine and Joy, a tall, stern figure in a black suit that had last seen good use in the late 1950s, standing quietly beside the grave. Tom turned towards the departing Patrick and Annie, evidently deciding his place was with them, first propelling Kate towards her mother. But Kate, at the sight of her mother's resolute black back, began to cry, and Sabine motioned to him that he should take her with him. If Grandmother was upset, the last thing she needed was Kate crying all over her. Joy, oblivious of the mud rising slowly over the sides of her shoes, stood beside the dark earth, encrusted with its floral burden, not looking at anything. She had half expected to cry, had rather feared embarrassing herself in front of all those gawping people. She knew she had probably disappointed them by not doing so. But the thing was, she felt rather better, as if a huge cloud had been blown away. "Sorry, dear," she told him silently, as soon as she acknowledged it. "You know I don't mean you." It was rather easier talking to Edward now he was gone, as if not seeing him there, in his pain and incapacity, a physical reminder of their life before, had freed her to love him uncomplicatedly again. She knew her manner had lightened, that Julia and Mrs. H. and all the rest were treading carefully around her, believing this somehow to be the calm before the storm, that they were predicting perhaps it would be tonight at the wake that she would retire, felled by grief. She had told him silently that she might do that, just to keep them happy. She wanted to give him a good send-off, yes, but she didn't want to spend too much time playing the hostess, keeping the near strangers happy. She still didn't really like parties, even now. Edward would understand that. Joy blinked, suddenly aware that she had let her umbrella fall forward and that rainwater was now trickling down her back. She looked up at the sky, wondering absently whether the paler patch of grey would infect the rest, then turned to find Sabine beside her. The young girl was staring up into her face, her eyes swollen, her expression concerned, and she slid her young arm determinedly through hers, as if comforting them both. "Are you all right?" she said. "I'm fine, Sabine." Joy stared down at where the coffin lay. It didn't seem to have anything to do with Edward. "Are you sad?" Joy smiled, thought for a minute. "No, darling, not terribly. Not for him, anyway." She took a deep breath. "I think your grandfather was ready to go. He was rather an active chap, and I don't think he liked sitting around doing nothing. I couldn't wish for him to be alive longer than he was."
"But won't you miss him?"
Joy paused.
"Of course I'll miss him. But we had some lovely times, your grandfather and I, and I'll have those forever."
Sabine seemed satisfied. "And I suppose you don't have to worry about him any more," she said.
"No, none of us do."
The sky was definitely clearing a little. The rain came down in finer threads, as if no longer convinced by its own invincible right to deluge, and already considering its next destination. The two turned and began to walk back down the hill.
"I've got something for you," said Sabine suddenly, reaching into her pocket. "It was in the last box of stuff in the study. I thought you should have it today. I mean, I don't know anything about religious stuff, but Mrs. H. says readings can be a comfort at, well, times like these."
She handed her grandmother a scrap of paper, handwritten and faded by age. She had to move closer under Joy's umbrella to save it from getting wet, but even then at least two of the words got splashed, sending the ancient ink bleeding outwards in minuscule tendrils of blue. "That by the assistance of His heavenly grace you may govern and preserve the peoples committed to your charge in wealth, peace, and godliness. And after a long and glorious course of ruling a temporal kingdom wisely, justly, and religiously, you may at last be made partaker of an eternal kingdom, through the same Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen."
"It's your writing, so I thought it might mean something to you. Is it all right? I mean, it is a religious thing, isn't it? I know you're not really a God-botherer or anything, but I thought it might be fitting for Grandfather."
Joy stood, gazing at the little piece of paper, as it became gradually softened and darkened by the droplets of water, and felt a large lump lodge somewhere in her throat.
"It is your writing," said Sabine a little defensively.
"Yes, it is my writing. And it is sort of religious," Joy said,
her voice cracking.
But, yes, it is all right. In fact, it's very appropriate. Thank you very much.
Sabine smiled approvingly, grief clearing from her young face like the clouds above them.
Good. As I said, I'm usually a bit rubbish at that kind of thing, she said.
And then, arm in arm, a little unsteadily as they tried to negotiate the rough ground, the old woman and her granddaughter splashed their way back towards the house. The end.
You have been listening to Sheltering Rain by Jojo Moyes, narrated by Judith Boyd.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this programme.